Welcome to China in Context. I'm John Andrews, author of The World in Conflict and a former Asia editor of The Economist. Now, China and Japan, as all observers of Asia are well aware, have a complicated, troubling history. The Chinese have painful memories of Imperial Japan's invasion of their country in the 1930s, and that's an issue which continues to stir resentment. Since the end of the Second World War, the two nations have followed very different paths politically. Japan is an ally of the United States with a liberal, democratic government. China continues to be run by the Communist Party, first under Mao Zedong and now under Xi Jinping. Nevertheless, the two countries enjoy close economic links. In fact, Japan's biggest trading partner is China. Today, we'll take stock of how China and Japan see their roles in the world. And I'm joined to discuss these issues with Duncan Bartlett, who usually serves as the host of this podcast. Duncan is a research associate at SOAS China Institute, and he writes regularly for the press in Japan. Duncan, it's good to have you with us. Let's start by discussing a recent summit meeting in Washington between the leaders of the United States, Japan, and the Philippines. What was the significance of that meeting, and what long-term gains are the leaders seeking?
Well, the focus was on China, and the Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida made that absolutely clear. He condemned what he called China's dangerous and aggressive behavior in the South China Sea. It was also, I think, very significant that the Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. was there, because he's been accusing China of coercive activity around his country. What was interesting was that Joe Biden said that if the Philippines are attacked, then actually there's a mutual defense treaty with the United States, which means that the Americans would come to their defense. Well, that was music to the ears of President Marcos, and it also reminded me of the alliance between Japan and the United States. What we're looking at here is a commitment for these three countries to cooperate more closely on security. And not surprisingly, the reaction from China was pretty furious. So diplomats from both America and Japan were summoned to meetings in Beijing and given a dressing down. China said, "Your countries are engaging in bloc politics, and you're interfering in China's internal affairs." China actually said that Japan had taken wrong actions, and it also slammed the Philippines.
What does that imply, though? I mean, you know, China talked about resolute, necessary responses. What could those be, or is it just rhetoric?
I think that sounds like wolf warrior rhetoric to me. In other words, pretty strong nationalistic rhetoric from Chinese diplomats. China's not apologizing. It's not going to renege on its territorial claims, however spurious they are. On the other hand, I don't think China wants to escalate things. So I think we're probably in a kind of Cold War situation at the moment, a bit of a standoff. Japan says that China's military buildup is a matter of serious concern and a strategic challenge. But at the same time, Japan is saying it's important that both Japan and China make efforts to build constructive and stable relations. So there's still scope for collaboration, particularly in the business sphere. But in terms of security and defense, Japan is increasingly a very strongly committed partner of the United States and a strong supporter of Mr. Biden's Asia strategy.
Good point. Now, obviously, there's an election in the US coming up this November. And in Japan, Fumio Kishida's premiership, it seems to me, is in trouble because of a corruption scandal. What's your view of the outlook for the rest of Mr. Kishida's term as prime minister?
Well, let's think about Mr. Kishida's future as a politician first and foremost. I think his days are numbered, actually. And if you read the Japanese press, they're saying he'll be out of a job very soon. The Tokyo District Public Prosecutor's Office has charged 10 people, including influential people from within Mr. Kishida's party, the LDP, of falsely reporting around $7 million worth of political funding. So it's a slush fund, it's being described as. Mr. Kishida responded by sacking 4 influential cabinet members last year. That was clearly a bid to save his premiership. Has it worked? Not really. He's still getting a lot of bad headlines. Every time the issue is discussed on Japanese news programs, Mr. Kishida gets the blame. And it's having a dreadful impact on his opinion poll ratings. He's an unpopular prime minister and is also dragging down the popularity of the LDP. Do I think that they could be defeated by an opposition party in the next general election? I think that's unlikely because the opposition are quite divided and the LDP has a history of springing back from such scandals and so on and may well replace its prime minister. And there is an unusual aspect of Japanese politics, which is that it's very factional. I'm wondering if the current foreign minister, Yoko Kamikawa, might be a potential candidate. It would be interesting, wouldn't it, if Japan had its first female prime minister?
Indeed. But let's put aside Ms. Kishida's own current problems as prime minister. He's actually followed a policy which was first advocated strongly by Shinzo Abe, fellow LDP prime minister, namely to ensure that Japan becomes a more assertive country internationally, including in the defense arena. How do you see Japan's relationship with America then, and with other US allies?
Well, Mr. Kishida is strikingly popular in the United States, and that's a contrast to the problems that he's having domestically. His visit to Washington went down very well, actually. And that's because he's an enthusiastic supporter of Mr. Biden's strategy of improving America's relationships with allies, friends and like-minded countries in the Indo-Pacific, maintaining an international order based on the rule of law. And when Mr. Kishida spoke to the US Congress, he said, "We'll be your global partner in the years ahead." Now, I think that was a significant phrase because listening to him were supporters of both Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And I think what Mr. Kishida is really saying is, even if there's a change of prime minister in Japan, even if there's a change of government, still think of my country as being a partner to the United States. And the implication, of course, would be that if President Trump came back in, Japan is the sort of partner that would share the burden of its own security by having a high level of defense spending. And that, I think, means that the long-term prospect is that Japan will remain a very close ally of the United States. In fact, probably its closest and most reliable ally in Asia. And I don't think there's any real prospect at the moment of America withdrawing its huge military presence from Japan, or indeed keeping Japan protected under its nuclear umbrella.
Very, very interesting, Duncan. In the years ahead, a fascinating phrase. In the years ahead, do you therefore see Japan being formally allied with AUKUS, which is the Australia, the UK and the US deal on submarines in the Indo-Pacific region?
Well, the British and Australian defence ministers are certainly open to the idea. They've discussed enhancing cooperation in Japan, but I have noticed that they've stopped short of saying that Japan should actually join AUKUS. Instead, what they're saying is that they'll explore the idea and perhaps partner with Japan on certain aspects of hypersonic weapons, that kind of thing. There should be, I think, increased cooperation between the militaries of all those different countries. They're likely to take part in joint exercises, probably in Australia, actually, as they did in 2023. But there is a bit of an issue here for Japan, and that is that AUKUS has a nuclear element to it, because the British and the Americans have said that they're going to provide nuclear-powered submarines to the Australians. And that's a concern in Tokyo, because Japan doesn't want to be seen to do anything to set back the efforts to prevent proliferation of nuclear weapons.
But on the face of it, Duncan, this is slightly odd, because after all, these submarines could be nuclear powered, but not necessarily nuclear armed. And at the same time, I mean, Japan was a victim of nuclear bombs, but Japan has been using nuclear power itself, nuclear energy, for almost 60 years. Why should it be a bar to their sort of acceptance of AUKUS?
Well, I've been thinking about that issue too, John. I mean, it does seem inconsistent, doesn't it, for the Japanese to enthusiastically cooperate on nuclear power projects all around the world, but to be so squeamish about nuclear-powered submarines, doesn't it? Well, you know, countries can be politically inconsistent. And I think there's something to note about the US approach to nuclear-powered submarines. America doesn't say which ones of those nuclear-powered submarines are also nuclear-armed. So I'll give you a little example. Last year, an American submarine went to Busan in South Korea, and the South Korean president stood on top of the US sub and said, "Let me give you a warning, North Korea. If South Korea is attacked by North Korea, South Korea's allies will respond in such a way as to put an immediate end to the regime in North Korea." Well, that was a pretty threatening. And you can understand, actually, why there might be quite a lot of anxiety among the more dovish politicians in Tokyo about Japan getting involved in a situation in which it was basically standing behind the Americans as they pointed nuclear missiles at Beijing.
Nicely put, Duncan. You mentioned South Korea. I mean, South Korea and Japan have had a rather troubled history, to put it mildly, but now, of course, are quite friendly in a sense, particularly at the leadership level. What are the prospects for a security pact between Japan and South Korea?
South Korea and Japan have so much in common, don't they? But their problems stem from Japan's colonial rule of the Korean Peninsula, which lasted from 1910 to 1945, during which many Koreans were very badly treated by Japan's Imperial Army. Now, what we've seen in recent years is a big effort on both sides to try to put aside those historical issues and to look at their common interests at the moment. And that was very clear when there was a meeting between the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, and Joe Biden at Camp David in America last summer. And they all came out of that saying they wanted to expand trilateral cooperation, and they talked about strengthening the rules-based international order. So this fits in with Mr. Biden's plan to strengthen and enhance bilateral alliances with both Tokyo and Seoul, and also bring those two Asia-Pacific allies closer together to boost deterrence, both against China and against North Korea, because Japan sees South Korea as absolutely crucial in trying to prevent dangerous actions by North Korea, and in particular on putting pressure on North Korea not to fire those missiles into the Sea of Japan, setting off alarms on the mobile phones of every single citizen in Japan, causing people to be very afraid.
Duncan, thank you very much for a sobering, intriguing, and I think very wise assessment. Thank you very much for your expertise today on this podcast. That was Duncan Bartlett, a research associate at the SOAS China Institute, part of the University of London, which makes this podcast. You can find out more about the Institute's courses and research at soas.ac.uk. But for now, that's all from us here at the China in Context podcast team.